Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi everybody! Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Doctor Who books put out by Target Novelizations from 1973 onward in publication order. We're a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. This episode is being released less than 12 hours after the worldwide premiere of The Giggle, the last episode of the David Tennant return era, the 14th Doctor era, and the beginning of the 15th Doctor Shuti Gatwa era. We are also looking today at a story from 1965, The Mythmakers. This being Doctor Who literature, we are going to spend a lot more time talking about The Mythmakers than we are The Giggle. My guest this week is Cy Hart, a very good friend and one of the most frequent guests on this program. But, of course, Cy and I were talking before The Giggle released. We are going to offer our predictions. One of us turned out to be very, very, very right about what was going to happen to The Giggle, and the other one of us, whose name rhymes with Jason, turned out to be very, very wrong. That interview with Cy is coming up, as well as my breakdown of the text of the Donald Cotton novelization from 1985, a remarkable book. If you have been following me in this journey in publication order, you probably have never seen another book like this out of the first 96 proper targets. So here with book 97, The Mythmakers, we are going to see techniques that we have never seen before, and they are well worth talking about. But before we do that, we need to talk about The Giggle, and there's only one person that I can bring to you on short notice to bring an expert, informed, hard-hitting, perceptive opinion about The Giggle. And that's my daughter, last heard on this show in episode 85, discussing Enlightenment. Please welcome back Callie as we discuss an episode that we watched together. So Callie, welcome back to my show.
It's good to be back.
Or is this your show and I'm your special guest?
I think you probably couldn't say that.
You and I have just watched Doctor Who, the latest episode airing live on Disney Plus, thanks to the digital miracle of streaming, we can watch it in America at the same time as my friends in the UK. What was the episode called?
The Giggle.
Going into it, what were you expecting?
I mean, I had watched the previous special Over Your Shoulder. I had assumed it would have been some sort of continuation of that, and it was. Kinda.
Now, you have not watched as much Doctor Who as I have.
Not even close.
Although it's fair to say that not as many people have watched as much Doctor Who as I have.
That's a pretty fair conclusion to come to.
Now, we're going to make this a spoiler-free review, so we're not going to reveal what happens over the last 20 minutes. We'll just talk about the elements of the episode.
Okay.
David Tennant's Doctor. Love him?
No.
No, why not?
I just think he treats Donna pretty poorly, and he's very prone to anger. I don't know.
What are some examples of how he treats Donna poorly?
Well, in the last episode...
Yes, Wild Blue Yonder.
That's what it was called?
Yes.
Well, he keeps losing her, first of all. And he doesn't listen to her. Like, there was the point... there's a lot of miscommunication going on between them. But
is he a good listener?
Not at all.
Does he value what she has to say because she's a woman?
Not really. The only time I really saw him valuing her was the time that, like, she said that he had, like, fast typing.
That was at the beginning of this episode.
That was the beginning of this episode, but, like, before that, Donna tries to talk sense into him and he just ignores it. Like, at the beginning where he talks about just, like, leaving and wandering and staggering, and he just kind of literally ignores her to go to the shop. The toy shop.
So she's telling him to slow down, you're running too fast, and he says, I've got a better idea, I'm going to run really fast.
Yeah.
So if we're not a fan of David Tennant, what do we think of Catherine Tate, who plays Donna?
I really like her.
What do you like about her?
She's smart, first off. I mean, even through all of that ignoring, she still cares about the Doctor.
even though he's like a jerk to her at times.
Yeah.
Now, the villain in this episode is played by Neil Patrick Harris, who I'm sure you know from Doogie Howser, M.D.?
No.
How I Met Your Mother?
Uh-uh.
It's a Sin?
Never heard of it.
Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle?
What is that?
Neil Patrick Harris played the MC in Cabaret on Broadway.
Oh, well, I've heard of Cabaret.
All right, I guess he's a little before your time.
I guess so.
So he plays a villain in this story called the Toymaker. Now, right before I watched The Giggle, I watched the only surviving episode of the original 1966 episode called The Celestial Toymaker.
Yes.
With a different actor, Michael Goff, playing the Toymaker. Michael Goff can't play the Toymaker anymore because he died 15 years ago.
Oh.
So American actor Neil Patrick Harris is playing the Toymaker now. What did you think of Neil Patrick Harris in this episode, having never seen him in anything before, which is kind of shocking, by the way?
Well, first off, I didn't realize he was American. Stunning accents. I thought he was good. I liked how he sort of portrayed this very eccentric, sort of strange, creepy vibe. I think the German accent was also a very nice touch to that. I think he did an excellent job. However, the climax.
Well, we're not going to talk about the climax because this is going out the day of the episode and we want folks to have time to watch it and make their own judgments about the ending.
Right.
But obviously, when you have a being as powerful as the Toymaker, the final battle between him and the Doctor must be epic and intense and super complicated, right?
No. I mean, I think that sort of falls into the craziness of the Toymaker. Sort of falls into this... I mean, he's this being that follows no rules except for the rules of the game. So, games don't typically end very climactically. Unless it's, like, a very long campaign.
You and I have had some pretty epic battles of Connect Four over the years.
I guess.
Imagine if you had to play the Celestial Toymaker at Connect Four with the fate of the universe in the balance, and if you lost, you became his plaything. Who would win?
I don't know. I don't know if he's ever... I mean... I don't know, it's such a different game than the ones he normally plays. He normally plays, like, mind games. Connect Four is pretty simple. I think I have... I give it a 60-40 chance. I say I got 60% chance I win.
So in the episode, there were several returning characters from previous Doctor Whos that you probably have not seen. What did you think of some of the returning characters?
I thought they... Which ones were the returning characters?
Well, Mel was a returning character from the 1980s.
I liked her.
Played by Broadway actress Bonnie Langford.
I thought she was pretty cool.
You had Gemma Redgrave, who's from a long British acting family dynasty. She played the head of UNIT, Kate Lethbridge-Stewart. What did you think of her?
Thought she was also very cool. I thought everybody working at UNIT were all, like, super smart, except for the ones that kept trying to shoot the Toymaker.
Yeah, alien menaces are usually immune to bullets, so it's very hard to shoot them with guns.
That's true.
And what did you think of Shirley, the scientific advisor with spina bifida? She was in a wheelchair.
I thought it was her character is super smart, super cool. But I also thought it was cool how they sort of portrayed her disability. They talk, like, there are a couple pretty lighthearted jokes made about that. I like how it's not really important to the story, but it's not like it's not recognized. Like, there are a couple parts where it's sort of made aware, because it's very visual, but you're aware of it, but it's not integral to the story.
Now, people on the internet...
Oh, God.
Hold on to your chair. Okay. Don't fall off.
Okay.
People on the internet were very upset by the fact that she was able to use her legs, even though she was in a wheelchair. This was actually a thing on the internet 2 weeks ago. People were upset.
Oh. I think... If you're going to be upset about that, that's probably not. I don't think that's something to be concerned about. I don't think somebody else's disability is something that anyone really else, especially someone watching them on TV, should be concerned about.
Well, people were very concerned, believe you me.
Oh, very much so.
Now, there was a bit of an unsubtle message in this episode about people in the 21st century having the belief that they are always right and that everything they say is right and everything else is incorrect. What do you think of the message?
I thought it was nice. I think it's cool when stuff like that is exaggerated because it provides a very unique social commentary on, like, the state that we are living in now. I think it provides a very unique commentary to that and how we live in our day-to-days, because obviously we're not going to be all crazy about that, running around screaming. But it definitely does exist, especially on the internet.
Now, early on, Unit discovers that there is a way to cure this terrible thing that is happening to people all across the world, believing they're always right. All you have to do is wear a special armband that cancels out the brainwave.
Right.
Then we see one news anchor rip the armband off.
Yeah.
Saying that she doesn't believe in it.
Anti-vaxxing.
Exactly, anti-vaxxing.
It's the same thing as, like, anti-vaccines, because some people are just so stuck in their own heads that they refuse to accept anything that will help them.
That's right. They believe that it comes from somebody else, it's wrong.
If it's not from them, then it's wrong. But things could be right and then not from that person.
So overall, the episode had some social commentary, it had some returning companions, there were a multitude of continuity references to the original series from episodes that I haven't showed you yet.
Good to know.
And there was David Tennant. This is believed to be his final story as the Doctor, having started the role in 2005.
Oh, five.
And it's also probably Catherine Tate's last appearance, unfortunately. Oh. We like her.
We do like Donna.
What did you think of the episode overall on a scale out of 10, and would you watch the new Dr. Shuti Gatwa when he takes over the role on Christmas?
Okay, so for your first question, out of 10, I give it a 7. I don't want to go into too much detail because that might spoil things, but I think overall it was a decent way to tie up everything. I think it was a decent way to end it. I think there were some parts that were a little strange, but I think overall it was decent. And I actually would be interested in seeing Shuti Gatwa in the new series. I would love to see a few episodes of that, yes.
All right, well, his first episode airs on Christmas Day. It's called, I believe, The Church on Ruby Road. And then his full season begins in the spring of 2024.
Oh.
Callie, thank you so much for joining me. Can I have my show back now?
No.
Traveling the Vortex. Are you ready to embark on an epic journey through time and space? Join the thousands of Whovians around the world who've discovered Traveling the Vortex, the ultimate Doctor Who podcast for diehard fans and curious newcomers alike.
Every week, we dive deep into the Whoniverse, discussing the episodes, theories, and hidden gems. We dissect the Doctor's adventures, share behind-the-scenes stories, and explore the legacy of this iconic show.
Traveling the Vortex brings fans together, fostering a global community of Whovians. Whether you're a fan of classic or new Who, there's something for everyone.
Join us on this incredible journey as we unravel the mysteries of time and space.
Don't miss out. Subscribe to Traveling the Vortex today on your favorite podcast platform.
Traveling the Vortex. Your ticket to adventure awaits.
Traveling the Vortex is a proud member of the Direction Point Podcast Network. You're listening to the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. Keep turning the pages.
Like a sword and sandal clad warrior striding across the plain, back in the arena for more combat, is one of my most frequent guests, Mr. Cy Hart. Cy, welcome back.
Hello, Jason. It's good to be back, and good to be back for such a brilliant book.
I was looking for a suitably myth-making introduction.
Oh, very good.
But before we talk about the book, there is a lot of news to cover in the Doctor Who world. I understand, Cy, that after years of being a permanent guest and being one of the hosts of Maximum Power, you now have, finally, your own solo podcast.
I do, yes. Yeah, I have taken the plunge after coming up with an idea about 18 months ago, and with an idea that I thought I could complete before the 60th anniversary. And then DWM stole my idea, which was 60 objects for 60 years. And so I just thought, well, it's a really good idea. I'll just keep it and have it for myself. So, yes, I have the Library of Impossible Things, where Doctor Who fans bring an object that symbolises their fandom and have a chat, really, about what it is to be a fan of Doctor Who and their story of their fandom.
How many episodes in are you?
I've just recorded episode 4 this week. So it's a bit slow at the moment, but sort of due to personal circumstances and things, getting recordings has been a bit trickier than I expected. But yeah, it's building up nicely, and there's been some very lovely comments. So, and the first episode was just me rambling on, and people seem to really enjoy that. So that was lovely.
Now that we are past the 60th anniversary, though, there's really no need to limit yourself to 60 objects, especially because if you're not doing an episode a week or an episode a month, you could get to 65 or 70. So there's really no reason even now to limit yourself at 70.
Oh, no, no, no. I don't intend to. So that was my original hook, because I thought it would be a finite thing and I'd be lucky to get 60 people. And then a very large number of people came forward and said, oh, I'd like to do that. So, I've got a good list of people to come on. So just over 60. So I've just got to schedule them all now. So, and I'll be looking forward to you joining me at some point soon, hopefully.
Looking at my podcast app, you have yourself, you have Fraser Gregory and Daniel Knight, who are all regulars on this show.
Yep. Well, start off with regular podcasters. And then my fourth guest is an old friend who's never done a podcast before Monday morning when he recorded with me. So I'm very excited to get him on the show. So that'll be good.
And we are talking today about a season 3 William Hartnell story. Mythmakers was the first story made in production season 3, which wraps with the Smugglers. And I'm looking to do a separate bonus episode about this with Jim Sangster, because the history of the production of the show in season 3, the wheels are falling off, right? So you have two producers throughout the season, two story editors, one Doctor who is nearly fired multiple times throughout the run of the year, and I think you have a total of 7 different companions starting off the season with Stephen and Vicky. Maureen O'Brien gets fired in between production seasons while on vacation after shooting Galaxy 4, and nobody bothers to tell her she's fired until she reads the scripts for Horse of Destruction. And by the end of the year, you've gone through several other companions, two of whom are killed off after very short-term contracts ran out. Then you wind up the year with Ben and Polly, who are quickly fired moments into the fourth production season because there was yet another changeover in production team. So while Mythmakers is the beginning of what turns out to be a very long and unhappy journey for William Hartnell, we just got some news today about another season 3 serial that is being revived in a rather striking way. Do you want to break us in on the fast breaking news item?
Well, yes. It turns out, not wholly unexpectedly, that The Celestial Toymaker is coming to DVD and is being animated in a very interesting style. I'm not sure about this. The design, I think, looks great from the little teaser, but I'm not sure about the character animation this time.
I don't do programming. I'm not a computer's guy. Mm-hmm. But I do remember being on the internet in the late 90s and the early 2000s. And it strikes me that this is the kind of animation that you would see online 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
I mean, the characters, the geography of the... that doesn't sound right. I think the geography is not the word that I'm looking for, but the characters' shapes and the way they walk is not anything approaching naturalism. So there are two arguments to be made for a very unnatural style. Number one, you could say that it fits the story because Celestial Toymaker takes place outside of time and space. You have a being with cosmic, almost godlike powers who's able to make the Doctor disappear, and in fact was almost responsible for the first regeneration. They were going to replace William Hartnell in between episodes 1 and 4 when he was on vacation and just fire him and have a new actor play the role, because that's what the Celestial Toymaker can do. So it makes sense on the one hand to have this kind of stilted animation style to fit the particular tone of the story. On the other hand, you could say it's just not very good-looking animation, especially now that we're in 2023 and there have been great advances in technology since then.
Yeah, that said, I did like the design of the realm, and making that a bit more nightmarish and weird, I think worked really, really well. And sort of the big void and the giant robots looked really cool. So maybe that will be enough to sort of swing it. And we've only seen a tiny teaser, and maybe it's one of those things that will get better the sort of more you see it, perhaps. That's my natural optimism kicking in there.
One thing I did like was the size of the animation. One of the complaints that I have is that when Doctor Who was filmed in Lime Grove D, the camera was up very, very close. So when the Zarbi is bumping into the camera in the web planet, that's not a bug, pardon the pun, the Zarbi being a bug. It's a feature because the cameras are only probably not even a foot away from what they're filming. So it stands to reason that a unwieldy, cumbersome prop might bump into the camera because the camera's right there. So I want the animation to be as claustrophobic and up close as the filmed video was for the Hartnell era. So when you watch a show like Galaxy 4 and you read the production notes, the camera scripts for Galaxy 4 involve extreme close-ups. The actors' faces take up 90% of the screen. And if you watch the surviving Episode 3, that works stupendously under the hands of Derek Martinez. When you watch the Galaxy 4 animation, and this is not a knock on the animation at all, this is a comparison. The Galaxy 4 animation takes advantage of the cosmic setting, and the camera's always far back, and there's very small figures in the foreground because the camera's so far away, and there's bright color schemes, and it's very, very cinematic, in a way that Galaxy 4 in black and white Lime Grove D never was cinematic. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, I want to see animation that matches what I would see if the episode were ever to be recovered out of Jan Vincent Rudzki's sock drawer, or whichever fandom figure of conspiracy choice might happen to be holding on to this. I would like to see Celestial Toymaker as it was, but they're taking advantage of the format here. You actually have what appear to be suns and moons rising and setting behind the TARDIS as they materialize in the reception room. That is a great effect, and it could not possibly have been done in 1966 at the hands of Bill Sellers.
No, exactly. So, you know, I'm sort of always in two minds about this. I think if you're going to animate something, I don't think there's any point really in slavishly recreating the past, unless it is sort of going to be a sort of piecemeal thing with any existing episodes. But if you're going to do the whole lot, I'm a big believer in just thinking, let your imagination run wild and do what they would have done if they'd had the money and the budget and the time and the space to have done this in the 60s.
And this is a very specific complaint. This is almost a selfish complaint about being spoiled for choice. I kind of wish, on the one hand, that all the animations, and they've been doing these for over 15 years now, I kind of wish that the animations all had their own house style so that you could watch all the way from Galaxy 4 through the Invasion, all the animated stories, and see the same animation style and the same format. It seems like they're reinventing the wheel almost every time out with a different animator and a different style and a different format. So that if you put the Invasion next to the Reign of Terror, next to Galaxy 4, next to Power of the Daleks versus Celestial Toymaker, and especially considering the Web of Fear with the motion capture, none of these stories look as if they come from the same show. When we're doing the pilgrimage, I would like to see uniformity. And again, I realize this is a terrible thing to complain about. Oh no, we've been given too many different animators. It does mean that when I watch the animation, it does sort of take me out of the pilgrimage, takes me out of the era a little bit. That's, again, an observation and not an actual complaint. I'm not trying to Ian Levine, the new animator.
I was just going to accuse you of that, so I'm glad I didn't have to.
He has also mentioned that he wants to see slavish recreation of the original in-house style for animation, and I feel bad about saying that, knowing that he's also said it in a much more entitled way.
Yep.
I think there's merit to what he says, if not necessarily in the way that he says it and the way that he attacks people who disagree.
Well, that's very him. Yeah, I get it. It can go either way. And I, to be honest, I'm just quite happy to be able to watch these stories in some form or other. So I'm not very good at recons, so I much prefer the animation generally.
And I will say they also include the recons and the surviving episodes on the DVD. So if you wanted to buy the DVD and skip the animation and just watch a high-def recon, you could do that. So the discs serve multiple purposes.
Yeah, there's always options. And that's the good thing about this range, is that they always give you those different options.
Well, speaking of options, the story of the week is a story that can be experienced in multiple ways, and we'll talk about as many of them as we can today. You have the novelization, which comes out in 1985. You have the audiobook release with the great Stephen Thorne, and Stephen Thorne being the Doctor Who equivalent of a literal Greek god, having played Omega, what better choice than to voice the Mythmakers? You also have the loose canon reconstruction, which, because this was made during an era of the show when the producer was not paying John Cura for telesnaps, you don't have telesnap reconstructions. There's very little surviving material from this story. So the loose canon recon, while it doesn't recreate the visual look of what Michael Leiston Smith would have been doing in Limegrove D in 1965, does give you a sense of what the actors and costumes and action would have looked like. They even animate or use recycled film footage to animate the sword fight in episode one. And then, of course, there are also the online transcripts, and there is the official BBC audio release, I believe from the year 2000, narrated by Peter Purvis, which I have in the other room. I don't know if they're ever going to animate Mythmakers, because there's so little surviving material, but there are surviving 8mm off-air clips, including what is possibly, we're not quite sure, Vicky's departure scene from episode 4. So with all those choices, Si, how did you first come to Mythmakers, way back at the dawn of your fandom?
It would have been the book. I can't remember. I sort of have vague memories of actually borrowing this from my friend Richard back in the day, because it wasn't one I got till a bit later. So I borrowed his copy, which he'd got from his collection, and read it. And as a 11 or 12, I'm 12, I probably was when I read it, I didn't get it at all. I wasn't enthralled by it, and I wasn't really greatly enamored with it. I fell in love with the story when I heard the narrated soundtrack, and suddenly it clicked, and I thought, this is brilliant. And then I fell in love with the book when the audiobook version came out, and Stephen Thorne's narration was absolutely pitch perfect, and it's one of my favorites of the whole range. I love that range, as I've mentioned many times before anyway.
And you are not alone.
But his reading of it was absolutely stupendous, and he really, really got it and was a superb Homer. Ever since, that's I've listened to that a couple of times. This time I read the book for speed reasons rather than for any other reasons, because it's a long listen on the CDs. But yeah, it's a great listen.
I was also 12, or just about 12, when I got the novelization, and I'll talk a little bit about that on the audio essay which follows this conversation. I would tend to agree with you that I knew that what I was reading was supposed to be funny, but I also knew that I didn't have enough life experience to get where all the jokes were coming from. And there were distinct moments in my life where I encountered the references in this book in their original context years later and went, oh, so that's what Homer meant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think Donald Cotton was a brilliant and sophisticated writer, which is great, but it went over the heads of a lot of the readership that the book was aimed at the time. And it's one that, as an adult, I find absolutely a complete delight, and I love the anachronisms that he throws in and then sort of adjusts himself and says, well, how do I know that? Well, I don't know that. But this is what Vicky said. And I don't really understand what he said, even though he possibly does. And that's brilliant. That's really funny and really, really clever. But obviously, as a 12-year-old, no idea.
Yeah, I will say that reading this book now that I'm a few years past age 12, I probably got more out of the book this week, than I had at any time in the past.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably at least 25 years since I read this book. It's been a long time between rereads, which gives me curious, because Donald Cotton's last novelization, The Romans, and that's going to be several more months before we reach that on this show. I only read that once when I was in high school, 16 or 17, and it made no sense to me, and I never read it again. I am curious to see if I will appreciate the Romans more the next time around when I get to it in 2024. Have you familiarized yourself with the two other Donald Cotton books?
Yes. Well, The Romans was one that I had a very visceral dislike of when it came out. I can remember reading that and thinking, what is this? I don't get this at all. And again, earlier this year, I bought the audiobook, which is read by multiple people because it's multiple narrators writing letters. And it's absolutely fantastic. It's a great and really clever retelling of the story. But again, I wasn't the target age group for it, which is kind of ironic, it being a target book. You know, so that's one that has only improved again for me. And I was put my hand up and say I was completely wrong about that. If you'd asked me a few years ago what was my least favorite target book, that would have been very easily and very quickly the answer to that question. And the Gunfighters I like enormously as well. So I have post Finding the Mythmakers audiobook so enjoyable, I actually read the Gunfighters at that point because I thought, well, maybe I need to give this one another go, and that's very good too. So yeah, he's got a good hit rate now that I'm a middle-aged Doctor Who fan.
I know the last time that I read Gunfighters was exactly 10 years ago, because in 2013 I was trying to do the original version of my pilgrimage, but I was only watching one episode a night rather than two, and I lost a lot of time over the summer when I just fell out of the habit. But I got to the Gunfighters the weekend of the first L.I. Who convention, November 2013, and I brought the novelization with me to the convention. And I didn't really know anybody there at that time, so I was having dinner by myself in the hotel restaurant, reading the novelization of the Gunfighters along with my pot roast. So having the experience of reading that book while watching the episodes, I got the sense that the book was a lot more satirical and a lot more of a parody of Westerns than the TV production itself. But it's been 10 years. I'm curious to get to that book next month and see what my impression is. But for now, I can say I really get a lot more mileage out of this book than I ever did before. And that's because Cotton is writing at a very high level. So it's a book that grows with the audience, which a lot of targets, you really can't say that about.
No. It's absolutely true. And I mean, to sort of have the idea of writing this story as if it's Homer telling this story, I mean, that's pretty high concept for a target book. Even in 1985, that's pretty out there. And that would be pretty out there for any Doctor Who book to this day. So,
and so few books told in the first person. It's not a format that the show really invites itself for, because the house style was always don't get inside the Doctor's head. So you can't really have the Doctor narrating a novelization. You do have Ian narrating the very first book that came out in 1964.
Yep.
But other than that, the only other first-person narration books that I can think of, portions of Martin Day's Bunker Soldiers are narrated first-person by Stephen. And I think it was James Goss who wrote the new series adventure Blood Cell. That is narrated first-person by a secondary character, a guest character. So it's not attempted too often. I think the new adventures did portions of first-person narration through Bernice Summerfield's diary. But I don't believe there was ever a full book done from Benny's POV.
Not that I'm aware of. I know Ian Marta tried it for the Ark in Space, but it becomes logistically difficult to keep it in the first person when the character that you're narrating, the character's point of view that you're narrating the story from, isn't in all the scenes. And so how do you cover that? For a TV story, it's going to be really difficult to do this. But Donald Cotton works this brilliantly by having Homer as his narrator, who's not involved in the action, so he can comment on it, and he walks between the two different camps and gets involved with both sides and gets embroiled by losing his eyes gradually through the story as well. So
yes, with lots of foreshadowing as to how that's going to happen. I think the drawback there, as you say, is Homer can never narrate the full story because he's not there when the TARDIS dematerializes. So there's a cliffhanger at the end of this story that leads directly into the Daleks' master plan. Homer can't be there for that. And there does come a point in the story where Cotton goes from faithfully recreating the camera scripts, except Homer is narrating and taking on a couple of the dialogue lines himself. There comes a point, and I'll talk about this more in the essay, where he abandons the script entirely and just has Homer narrating something that only has a faint resemblance to what we saw on television. That comes very late in the book, and it comes very late in the day, but it is a necessity of the format, because at least if Harry is narrating Ark in Space, he was there in the final scene, whereas Homer would never know what happened after Vicky says goodbye and the TARDIS dematerializes with Stephen and Katarina on board. Unless you buy into the theory that Homer later becomes a companion of the Doctor. I think there is textual evidence for that, and I'll put it in the audio essay, but that wouldn't have happened at this point in time.
No. I did notice this time that sort of the final episode of the story is covered incredibly quickly, and a lot of stuff is brushed over that you get on the actual soundtrack of the story. So yeah, there's not a lot about the battle. There's not a lot about Vicky saying goodbye to the Doctor. Even this all happens very fast. And I was reading it at lunchtime today and thinking, oh, hang on, we're done. And I wasn't expecting that. And it was just a sort of few pages and it was all over after the horse arrived.
It's kind of Malcolm Hulk syndrome. Malcolm Hulk would lavish 50 pages on episode one, 40 pages on episode two, and then whoops, you only have 130 pages to work with there, Mac. And then parts 3, 4, 5, and 6 go by in an unholy blur. And Cotton is doing that. I think part one and part two take up like 90 pages of text, and it's only a book that ends on page 142. Something's got to give, and that's the finale.
Yeah, but, you know, to be honest, it's so entertaining that if that's the only thing you've got to knock this novel for, then that's not a bad hit rate overall.
Oh, absolutely not. And I'll save the rest of those thoughts for the audio essay, but I want to come over to the TV side of things. Have you ever watched the Loose Cannon recon or any other recon of the story, as the case may be?
I haven't seen any of the recons of this story, to be honest. So, no, I haven't seen it at all. I've obviously seen the clips that exist from it, such as they are, but that's the only sort of moving version of this story I've ever seen. I've only had sort of the audio before.
And I will give a shout out to friend of the podcast, Ian Potter, who wrote the Black Archives for this story. And he goes into incredible detail as to what was in the camera scripts and how this story would have looked with reference to Michael Leeson Smith's other work, such as on Zed Cars that we can see. We are losing a lot. So let me sidetrack to a different question. There are 97 missing episodes of Doctor Who still. And we've heard rumors there was a poorly written story in The Guardian last month about some stories possibly still existing in the hands of private collectors. Assuming that nothing is recoverable, assuming that all 97 stories are in fact lost and none of them can be found in Jan Vincent Rudzki's sock drawer, of the 97 lost stories, what are some of the, let's say five, what are the five individual stories out of those 97 that you want back more than anything else in the world? The next time there's an announcement, we found it. What are you hoping it is?
Well, to be honest, this one would be very, very near the top. This is one that, again, as an adult, I've loved. I've loved the soundtrack, and I would absolutely love to see how they did it. So this would definitely be one of the five. Up there with the Daleks' Master Plan, because that's just an incredible story as well.
But there's nine missing from Daleks' Master Plan out of 97, and there's four missing out of this story. If you could only pick one individual episode to recover, let's make it a little bit harder.
If it was just one. Well, it would probably be The Destruction of Time, I think, would be the one that I would want to see most, because it's just, because a lot of the soundtrack of that episode is just sound effects. I would love to see what is happening on the screen in that. But I would also be really fascinated to see the final episode of The Mythmakers because of the change of tone and sort of Vicky leaving and all of those things. I would be really, really intrigued to see that.
It's an idea that I've had, and I don't know if I'll ever do it, but a friend of the show, Bill Evenson, has the Frankenstein Minute podcast where they watch every movie in the Universal Frankenstein cycle from the 1930s and 40s. Then they do one episode for each minute on screen.
So wow.
After several years of the show, they're still only up to the third or fourth movie. You can't do that for the entirety of Doctor Who because that's millions of minutes. But if you take the 24 minutes of Mythmakers episode 4, you could do a 24-episode podcast covering each of those minutes because the tone shift happens at the fifth minute of the story. And the last 20 minutes are about as strong as Doctor Who had ever been to that point. And then the next story over is Dalek's Master Plan, where episodes 11 and 12 are about as strong as Doctor Who ever got. Followed by the Massacre, episode
which
4.
Which then becomes the strongest Doctor Who has ever been to that point.
Exactly. And then we're also missing episode 1 of Celestial Toymaker, which we don't know how outrageous Bill Sellers could have gotten versus the animation, which I'm sure is going to be outrageous. But their episode 1 of Toymaker is crying out for nifty visuals, and I am curious to see if those nifty visuals are there. The same way that Galaxy 4 surprised all of us by having such great visuals compared to what we were expecting.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot that I want to see back, but those are some prime candidates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they're really strong picks because they're episodes and stories that are sort of slightly out of the norm for what we know about Hartnell Who particularly. So I think they would be really intriguing. And I think Hartnell's performance in this story is really strong. And I love Hartnell when he's playing comedy, but also he flips in the last episode and is there sort of for the to deal with the tragedy of it all and everything else. So I think it would be a really his performance would be really, really good to see. And he's always so visual as well.
He was at his best when he was going one-on-one with an old-time British character actor. So he is terrific in The Romans. He is terrific in Mythmakers against Odysseus, Ivor Salter. Give him somebody to play off of and give him a historical or give him a comedy, and he is as good as a Doctor Who actor will ever get. However, let him act against an empty chair in a script like The Ark, and he's a little bit more lost.
Yes.
This is exactly what William Hartnell is for. And when the historicals are taken away from him and they put him in these wacky sci-fi adventures, that's when he sort of loses the plot and is forced out the door.
Yeah, he's not always so comfortable. I imagine those scenes where he's coming up with the ideas of how to attack the Trojans and would be amazing. So sort of talking about making the aeroplane and firing it's like a giant paper aeroplane into the field and coming up with the design of the horse and all of that. I think those scenes would be played fantastically and be really, really good.
The catapult scene.
Yes.
Let's talk about some of the other performances in this story. You have Francis DeWolf, who had been pretty terrifying in his one episode of Keys of Marinus as Barbara's antagonist. And now he's back in what is not quite a hero role, but he is playing a hero by definition, and he's in episodes 1, 2, and 3. He has a lot to do. That's, I think, a strong performance. And then you have Barry Ingham, who had just come off the set of the theatrical film Doctor Who and the Daleks, playing a beglittered Thal.
Yeah.
And now he's coming to play Paris, Prince of Troy, only it's a comedy role because... Mm-hmm. Paris is a tremendous coward.
Yes.
And Donald Cotton has a lot of fun talking about that in the novelization. And I think you have a terrific performance out of Cassandra, but because the role doesn't exist on video, most folks don't talk about her because she never gets to meet the Doctor or Stephen.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. And yeah, I think she's really good. And I saw her at a convention last year, Frances White, who played her, and she speaks about it very fondly and and it was something that she enjoyed sort of quite early on in her career. So yeah, I think she's great, and she is obviously the setup for one of the greatest jokes in early Doctor Who, with the woe to the House of Priam, woe to the fall of Troy, and then the it's a bit late to say woe to the horse, which is just brilliant.
So you've only seen this story on audio. You have not watched the recons. And of course, the recons don't have any pictures from the episode, so you have a lot of composites of actors. What is your favorite performance in this story, the TV story?
It's sort of difficult to single anyone out because they're a really strong ensemble. But I do very much like Max Adrian, and his relationship with Vicky is really lovely, and that's really nicely developed. Sort of that fatherly concern that he has for her, and then he still throws her in jail as well. Yes. And that sort of flip flopping, I think he gives a really lovely performance.
Yeah, there's a lot of it's one of the great things about 60s Who is there is rarely a bad performance in the bunch, because you have very experienced stage and film actors doing television, a lot of veterans who knew exactly how to hit their marks and find the comedic and or emotional beats as necessary.
Yeah, and again, it's another character that flips between sort of the comedic and the touching, and then sort of the drama at the end. That's a lovely performance. But again, I think I don't think there is a duff performance in this. And if there is a duff performance, it might be Katarina.
Yes, I was coming to that. So when we learned, and it's been 20 years now, that Dalek's Master Plan Episode 2 had been found, my very first thought was Adrian Hill any good? Because I hadn't heard any of the surviving audio at that point, and she's only in 5 weeks of the show. What is it like when she shows up for a very small part in episode 4 as a hastily designed replacement companion for the rapidly fired, on no notice, Maureen O'Brien?
Well, it's odd because she just sort of turns up and there's no kind of hint that she's the new companion. It's not like companion introductions today where you know exactly who this character is and you know that they're going to be coming with you. It's a very strange decision that someone who gets so few lines and so little screen time suddenly ends up on the TARDIS. I mean, that's very Hartnell Who, that this is just sort of random chance, and it's only because Stephen is stabbed that she ends up nursing him and looking after him and taking him into the TARDIS. But yeah, it's very difficult to judge what she does in this story, because she does so little.
It was, I believe, the arc. It was they were scripting the arc, and that was the moment they realized they had to quickly fire Adrian Hill so soon after hiring her, because they realized they couldn't make the character work in a story that took place in the 57th segment of time, and she was from 56 segments earlier. Nowadays, there's a very easy workaround. If she's in the far future, put her in a booth and give her a brain enhancement.
Yeah,
with a little bit more knowledge into her brain, and then the character works. But they weren't going to be doing that in 1966, so they try to write the arc with her. They don't get very far. Okay, she's fired, and the very first thing she films on the show is her death scene.
Yeah, which is kind of tragic, really.
And then she doesn't engage much with fandom, and I believe she died fairly young in the grand scheme of things.
Mm-hmm.
So we never got to see her second act in Big Finish or coming back for a celebrity cameo in a Russell T. Davies story.
No, sadly not. We were denied that. So, but at least now we have one surviving episode with her, so we can see what she did and what she was like. And all I can remember is she seemed to deliver her lines with her head cocked quite a lot.
Yes. I remember not disliking her performance in the surviving bits of Dalek's Master Plan Episode 2, but again, she's playing a particular part, and it doesn't give her perhaps the range that modern-day companions are granted. She's not given as much to do as a Catherine Tate, for example.
No, of course not. So, yeah, you know, she's fine. But the Mythmakers doesn't give us very much to go on, and the novelization gives us even less to go on about her. So she's mentioned, but I'm not sure she even gets a line of dialogue in the novel.
And she was not one of Donald Cotton's original characters. She would have been put into the script probably at a very late date, remembering my Ian Potter. My recollection is from the Black Archives that Vicky was never supposed to leave in the original conception of the story. So all that was probably put in by the script editor.
Yeah, which might be why she gets such short shrift in the novel version then.
Right, because she wouldn't have been in whatever older drafts or notes that Donald Cotton was working from. But this is a very funny story, as you say, until episode 4 when it takes that sharp left turn into dark tragedy. What for you are some of the best lines in the story, some of the best gags?
I do love the line where when the Doctor arrives and he's being proclaimed as Zeus and says, so now to Lederer he came as a magnificent swan, and to us you've arrived as an old beggar. I love that. And William Hartnell spluttering in the background at the reaction to that is really brilliant. And I do love the sort of the concept that Paris, this great hero, is actually a bit of a coward and talks a good fight rather than actually fights a good fight. And the whole sort of business of him coming back and saying, I've slain Hector, I've been an amazing hero. And then they said, but if you'd not done this, then we'd have been spared a lot of difficult conversations and difficult situations that are to come and all of this. The reactions to everyone is brilliant.
Yeah, talking about Paris, I like the fact that Prime is always telling him to go back to the front lines and get killed in service to your country. Then with Achilles, the way that Odysseus is so dismissive of Achilles after Hector the Trojan is slain is hilarious.
Yes.
You found him, you say, as he lay dying. Never will give Achilles any of the benefit of the doubt about anything.
Not at all. He doesn't let up at all. And, and as I said, I just love the gags of the Doctor trying all the different modes of entering the city that's under siege and things like that. I think those are all brilliant and very funny, and sort of coming up with the sling and just like, no, this won't do, and we just need a tree trunk that we can propel. No, that's, we're not going to be able to do that. And it's just all so absurd. And then just the fact that they know... The horse is the thing that is going to do it, but Noah, he doesn't want to do it because that's history, and obviously that didn't actually happen. And then he actually makes it happen, like he does with Rome burning down in the Romans. There's sort of that precedent of making history happen again, which is very different to season one of Doctor Who, where you can't change history, and suddenly he's creating the myths himself.
There is a very funny bit in the book where Donald Cotton's Homer realizes that the Doctor has stolen his idea, although it's stealing an idea from a book that he hasn't written yet.
Yes.
And he starts lamenting about copyright law.
Again, a brilliant piece of anachronism through that. And as I said earlier, all those little asides where he's talking about things that he shouldn't know anything about are really, really brilliant. I love that. And again, the fact that they're fighting for Helen, the most beautiful woman in the world, and yet no one actually wants her back because she's a pain in the ass all the time. Because she's so beautiful, everyone just wants her, and she's going to be captured, and they're a lot better off actually without her while she's sort of being captured by someone else. Then that's fine. It keeps her out of their hair. I love that.
Does the book give us any special insight into Achilles, who's a rather small part on TV, pretty much disappearing after the first half of episode 1?
There's a little bit more, isn't there, I think. He's written up quite nicely from what I remember. And certainly he stood out in the early part of the book. But again, he sort of disappears.
I thought that Donald Cotton was making some rather sly allusions as to Achilles' sexual preference, but it is very subtle.
Yes, and there's a more recent retelling of the Achilles myth in a book called The Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller, which I read a few years ago, which overtly makes Achilles homosexual. And it's a brilliant read. If anyone wants to read about the life of Achilles, that is a great, great novel. So, I mean, there's obviously precedents in there, and this is someone pulling the myths apart and putting them back together again, in much the same way Donald Cotton is, maybe not quite so amusingly, but it's a brilliant sort of retelling.
We are reaching the point of the show where I would ordinarily play a game with the audience, but this week we are in the middle of exciting times. This episode is being released one day after The Giggle, which is the third and final episode that we know of David Tennant's return as the 14th Doctor. As you and I are recording this a few days before The Giggle, we are anticipating the return of the Celestial Toymaker, which ties in beautifully with the released animation that's coming out soon.
Yes.
And we are two episodes into the mini season. We have already seen the Star Beast, which is based upon a 1980 Doctor Who weekly comic. And we have also seen Wild Blue Yonder, which you and I discussed on Trap One.
Yeah, and had wildly varying opinions of.
So, in lieu of a game, I'm going to ask you just to give us quick reviews, first of Star Beast, and then of Wild Blue Yonder. And then I will ask you, what are your craziest predictions for what my listening audience has already seen, but which you and I have not yet seen?
Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed both stories in different ways. So, I mean, Star Beast, I really enjoyed because it was a Russell T. Davies season opener, which I always enjoyed. So one of the stories that isn't too demanding is just fun, gets the audience back into Doctor Who, sort of reminds them of who the characters are. You meet particularly sort of like partners in crime, and Star Beast have lots of things where it's a very cute looking alien creature who might not necessarily be evil, although obviously in the Star Beast it is. And it was just a really good, fun, exciting, and sort of lovely sort of return for Doctor Who that I thoroughly enjoyed. I'd read the Star Beast as a kid in Doctor Who Weekly, in sort of the issues that I picked up, and was always a story that I'd really liked. So I was delighted to see the Meep, and I fell in love with the Meep completely. So yeah, I was won over by that. And Wild Blue Yonder, I really enjoyed because I didn't know what was coming in the same way everyone else did. But I was on the edge of my seat throughout it. I thought it looked visually stunning. I thought the story was really interesting, and it really showcased what David Tennant and Catherine Tate could do, and how their acting prowess has developed and got even better than it was 15 years ago. So I was really glad Russell gave them a chance to grandstand and showcase what they could do in the double roles. And I thought it was just a really interesting and sort of different story. So I know we disagreed quite heavily on that, Jason, and this one didn't sit with you particularly well, but it was, yeah, I really enjoyed it.
I enjoyed elements of it. Like, I enjoyed the cold open with the reinterpretation of Isaac Newton, and I really enjoyed what turned out to be Bernard Cribbins's final ever
scene.
Based on the fact that he passed away in July and based upon the weather for the outdoor shot, I would imagine that was probably filmed within the last 60 days of his life, although I don't know exactly for sure.
Yeah, I'm sure it was sort of May, June time that they were out doing the location filming for these stories, so that would be about right.
But he had not lost a second off of his timing or his performance, so he was, maybe if he was not physically at his best, he was mentally ready to go.
Oh, absolutely. He was as sharp as ever and had lost none of the wilfness that we'd sort of looked forward to. So that, yeah, it was just really lovely that they managed to even get that one scene. And I think that knowing what happens sort of shortly afterwards, that makes it all the more treasurable that that was the very last thing he did on camera. And that's, and it was for Doctor Who.
And Russell T. Davies has teased that there are massive changes coming to Doctor Who mythology with the giggle. I'm trying not to focus on expectations. I try to go in with as few spoilers as possible, mm-hmm. and I try and enjoy the story minute by minute as it unfolds. Which led to some of my trouble with Wild Blue Yonder. Wait, is this all there is? This is all that's happening? Mm-hmm. They're walking down a corridor? But I'm curious to see what energy, because I've been watching Neil Patrick Harris since 1989, which is when his first U.S. sitcom, Doogie Howser M.D., premiered. I was 15 going on 16. I have spent decades of my life watching Neil Patrick Harris. I'm very curious to see what he is going to bring to his reinterpretation of the Toymaker. So what predictions, if any, do you have for the giggle?
Well, first of all, I just want to say, kind of ironically, in the UK, Doogie Howser M.D., replaced Doctor Who on TV in the same slot when Doctor Who finished. So, yeah. So I think it might have been between season 25 and 26 they showed it, and then after season 26. So Neil Patrick Harris destroyed Doctor Who in the UK.
So he was already playing the Toymaker in December 1989.
Yes.
That's hilarious, because when I had Paul Hayes on the show last month and we're talking about his new book, Pull to Open, I asked him, what did Doctor Who replace on the schedule? Doctor Who on Saturday nights in 1963 replaced the imported American cartoon Deputy Dog.
Yep.
So Doctor Who replaced the dog, but then Doogie replaced Doctor Who.
Doctor Who. So there we go. sort of prediction-wise, I've had this sort of inkling that Russell is, through the Tales of the TARDIS, sort of setting up the idea that a Doctor's incarnation can carry on post-regeneration, or can split, or the timeline will split off at that point. And I have this feeling that maybe David Tennant's 14th Doctor will eventually become the Curator and revisit the old faces and all of that. That's my little prediction.
Ah. Do you think so soon after Power of the Doctor that we're going to see either live footage of old Doctors as their current selves, or do you believe we're going to see archive footage of old Doctors in new formats, or do you believe it's going to be a little more integral to the story than that?
I think it might be a little more integral to the story by that. Russell's not one, I don't think, to sort of repeat those things. And because those Doctors have turned up in the Tales of the TARDIS, I think that may be enough for those. But it's entirely possible that if they were filming bits for that they might have filmed other bits to sort of suggest this and explain why those Doctors are back looking like... Who knows? He's a clever man. And I think whatever theories we come up with, he will be 60 steps ahead of where we are with our guesses.
And given that this was recorded 18 months ago, he would have had plenty of time to do post-production fixes. I don't have a prediction per se. I prefer to go in with no preconceptions at all. But we have this idea that when John Wiles was trying to get William Hartnell fired out in the middle of his contract, he was going to send the Doctor on vacation, and then have the Toymaker change the Doctor's face so that he comes back being played by a different actor.
Mm-hmm.
That would have fundamentally transformed the nature of the show, because maybe the show doesn't get to continue after the second actor leaves the role, because you don't have the inbuilt storytelling vehicle of renewal. It's better to have the Doctor's change of face be under his own power rather than something done to him by some malevolent outside force. But we know that the Toymaker canonically has the power to change people's appearance, because he can play with the raw essence of time. We've all seen the clip of Shuti Gatwa wearing what is probably the remains of David Tennant's 14 outfit, saying, "Can somebody tell me what the heck is going on here?" And I've slightly sanitized the language. I'm wondering if that doesn't occur in the cold open, with the toy maker playing with the Doctor's appearance before showing up to introduce himself to the Doctor. And then at the end, we get the regeneration proper. I'm curious if that is not a scene told out of sequence as part of the toy maker's antics and is not the actual aftermath of the regeneration itself. It's not a fully formed thought, but I think we might see a little bit of fluidity to the regeneration process because of the powers the toy maker has.
Yeah, I did wonder that as well. And sort of Russell, knowing his Doctor Who lore, it is entirely the kind of thing he would do, sort of remembering that that was why the toy maker was there in the first place, was to change William Hartnell's appearance and sort of do something huge to the Doctor. And of course, it's entirely possible that he will use the character in that way as originally developed. So yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see. And obviously do tweet in and tell me that I've got this completely wrong on when you hear this episode after the giggle's gone out.
And one last wild bit of supposition. Annika Wills was supposed to be in Power of the Doctor. There was an empty chair reserved for her in the event that Annika Wills could have flown out to the set. Annika Wills was at one point married to Michael Goff, the original Toymaker, although by all accounts he was not a good husband by any means. I'm wondering if they can finally bring Polly back, even if for a brief cameo, in the context of this being a Toymaker story.
Well, that's always a possibility, and it would be lovely to see her if she did.
You heard it here first, although as this is released on Sunday, you will have already seen the episode, so maybe you didn't hear it here first, but I said it first.
Yes.
All right, Cy, in wrapping up, you've already told us where we can find you, and you are working on the Library of Impossible Things. What is your release schedule?
So there should be another episode out next week with my friend Cy Hunt. So it's in the can, it just needs editing, so I will get on that so that you can all hear it very soon.
Cy Hunt and Cy Hart in the same episode, the same way that in our Wild Blue Yonder Trap 1, we had Doctor Who novels and Doctor Who novels.
Yes, exactly. It doesn't happen very often.
People with almost identical Twitter handles in the same fandom.
Mm-hmm.
And what else can we find you up to in the podcast sphere other than Library of Impossible Things?
So at the moment, Maximum Power, our Blake 7 podcast, is midway through Series C and going very well. So there'll be more episodes of that to come, and we'll be recording the final series early next year, hopefully. And otherwise, you'll hear me on many episodes of Trap 1 at the moment. So I've been quite prolific. And if you are so inclined, you can hear me and Jason talking about the Celestial Toymaker, which we recorded last year.
That's right, and there will be a new Trap 1 episode keyed to the animated DVD release, whenever that may be, and it's possible that one or more of our voices will return to talk about the Toymaker one more time.
There's a cliffhanger for you.
Cy, thanks again, as always, for dropping by. I'll see you real soon.
Yep, thank you very much, Jason.
Doctor Who, The Mythmakers, by Donald Cotton, televised as The Mythmakers, teleplay by Donald Cotton, televised in October and November 1965, paperback release date September 12th, 1985, target book number 97, cover artist Andrew Skilleter, long, long ago, on the Great Plains of Asia Minor, two mighty armies faced each other in mortal combat. The armies were the Greeks and the Trojans, and the prize they were fighting for was Helen, the most beautiful woman in the world. To the Greeks, it seemed that the city of Troy was impregnable, and only a miracle could bring them success. And then help comes to them, in a most unexpected way, as a strange blue box materializes close to their camp, bringing with it the Doctor, Stephen and Vicky, who soon find themselves caught up in the irreversible tide of history and legend. There are 97 missing episodes of Doctor Who, all from the 1960s. Perhaps you know this already. A few stories are recovered from time to time,
We got all of Tomb of the Cybermen back in 1991, all of Enemy of the World back in 2013, and several other bits and pieces in between. As I type this in the final month of 2023, it's been over a decade since any missing stories were returned, restored, and released. The Omni rumor, which spread during the 50th anniversary year that everything had been recovered in Nigeria, persisted for a while, and every so often there are rumors that some old film collector has missing stories in their home archives that they know are missing but won't return. Again, chances are if you're listening to this show, you know all this. In fact, chances are if you're listening to this program, you know more than I do, and some of you have even helped recover missing episodes yourself. Hi, Paul. Of those 97 missing episodes, 4 aired in the autumn of 1965 under the umbrella title The Mythmakers. The only Doctor Who serial, directed by Michael Leiston-Smith, gone at this point, quite probably forever. The only Doctor Who serial, scored by Humphrey Searle, gone at this point, quite probably forever. Fortunately, it is not the only Doctor Who serial written by Donald Cotton, who wrote one other TV story, which is fully extant, and novelized a third TV story, which is also fully extant. If you ask me which missing stories I most want back, as I asked Cy earlier, well, it's difficult to rank all 97 in terms of what I most want back. Remember, I didn't have high hopes for Galaxy 4 Episode 3 when that was announced as a recovery in 2011, but boy, am I ever glad we have it back now. I had super high hopes for Web of Fear Episode 4 when that was announced in 2013, and boy, was I right about that one. Now, I can make the obvious joke here and say that I couldn't care less if we ever got back more of the Faceless Ones or the Space Pirates, but hey, any recovered 60s story would be gold. But in the end, I'm pretty sure that I desperately want back something, anything, from the Mythmakers. Preferably Episode 4, but I take any bit of the story, from which we have barely anything surviving. Not even the John Curatella snaps. Now, I've had Ian Potter as a guest on this show before, in a bonus episode all to himself. He wrote The Black Archive for Mythmakers, and that's a book that made me keenly aware of just what we lost with the wiping and junking of the video. Ian's book went deep into trying to reconstruct the visual look of the story, how many camera switches Michael Leiston-Smith wrote into his scripts, how some of the cuts from camera to camera worked against the humor inherent in Cotton's draft scripts, what some visual effects of the city of Troy would have looked like, and then there's Cotton's story, which, to neatly map the title of Bob Odenkirk's autobiography onto this four-part serial, goes comedy, 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 drama. Episode 4, starting at about the 5-minute mark, gets dark and tragic in a hurry. Which brings us to the novelization. The book bemused me when I first bought it, in 1985, close in time to the paperback release date. Homer's first-person narrative threw me because I already would have known from the program guide that Homer was not a named character in the story, and I knew that there was a character named Cyclops in the cast list, but not important enough to figure into the program guide summary of the story. So I would not have had any idea when I first read the book what the shape of the TV story would have been, where the cliffhangers were, how much of the book was an accurate description of those lost TV broadcasts. Now, of course, it's nearly 40 years since I first bought this book. Most of us have heard the surviving audio, or watched the loose cannon reconstruction, or at least read the online transcript. Let's talk about how well this book works as a novel in its own right. I think it's safe to say that the table of contents is the best ever in the entire Target range without stooping to hyperbole. Let's read it together. 1. Homer remembers. 2. Zeus ex machina. 3. Hector forgets. 4. Enter Odysseus. 5. Exit the Doctor. 6. A rather high T. 7. Agamemnon arbitrates. 8. An execution is arranged. 9. Temple fugit. 10. The Doctor draws a graph. 11. Paris draws the line. 12. Small profit, quick return. 13.
War Games Compulsory. 14, Single Combat. 15, Speech. 16, The Trojans at Home. 17, Cassandra Claims a Kill. 18, The Ultimate Weapon. 19, A Council of War. 20, Paris Stands on Ceremony. 21, Dungeon Party. 22, Hull Low, Young Lovers. 23, A Victory Celebration. 24, Doctor and the Horse. 25, A Little Touch of Hubris. 26, Abandoned Ship. 27, Armageddon and After. So many matching title pairs, and preserving most of the TV episode titles. About a year after I bought the book, I saw my cousin Elizabeth perform in her high school's production of The King and I, and the song Hello, Young Lovers was a delayed explanation for Chapter 22. I grew up on a lot of my parents' Broadway sheet music collection and soundtrack cassettes or 8-tracks, but The King and I was not a show on which I was raised. Homer narrates the book. Now in my head, in November 1985, I mentally cast George Cormack, who played the Abbot in the final episode of Planet of the Spiders, which I had already seen. Chapter 1 is an invention of the author, a comedic prologue in which Homer purports to be sitting by the ruins of Troy, but also makes an instantly anachronistic reference to La Vie Parisienne, a publication that began life in 1863 CE, so about 3,000 years after the scene is set. I would have had little knowledge of the words lecher and libidinous on page 11. The TV story begins with Chapter 2, but it's told from Homer's POV rather than Michael Leeston-Smith's camera. And Homer is a discursive narrator. Page 14. Two men were fighting in a field, and the sound of it woke me up. The noise was excessive. There was, of course, the clash of sword on armor and mace on helm. You will have read about such things. And these I might have tolerated, merely pulling my cloak over my head with a muttered groan or a stifled sigh. It matters little which. But for some reason they had chosen to accompany their combat with an ear-splitting stream of bellowed imprecations and rhetorical insult, the like of which I had seldom heard outside that theater. What's its name? In Athens? You know the one. Big place. All right if it isn't raining, and if you care for such things, which I must say I rather do. But not thank you in the middle of a summer siesta, on a baking hot Asiatic afternoon, when my feet hurt and my head aches. The dust, too. They were kicking up clouds of it as they snarled and capered and gyrated. Made me sneeze. Now the text is sly and funny, a zinger on every page. This may be the first Target book in publication order to explicitly hint at LGBTQ issues. Page 14. He, Achilles, was more lightly armored than Hector, but I couldn't help feeling that this was not so much a matter of military requirement as of pride in the displaying of his perfectly proportioned body. He had that look of narcissistic petulance one so often sees on the faces of health fanatics, or on male models who pose for morally suspect sculptors. I believe the Greeks have a word for it nowadays. I definitely did not know what that meant in 1985. Or on page 16. Patroclus, a boy? Quite so. To understand is not necessarily to approve, says Cotton, for Homer, regarding Achilles. On page 21, the doctor will tell Achilles that he's considered sensitive on Mount Olympus. Another clue. Ian Potter in the Black Archive points out that the novelization contains a lot of dialogue from Cotton's surviving scripts that was cut for Leeston-Smith's camera scripts. We also lose in Chapter 3 TV scenes that the book's Homer could not have witnessed, the Episode 1 TARDIS scenes, that's replaced with more Homer-intentional anachronisms. Quoting the Bard's Scottish play, Act 2, Scene 3, on page 19, as a dying Hector's golden blood laces his silver skin, and Homer invites fewer poets to pick up the phrase. Page 20 has more anachronisms, Homer calling the Doctor a Time Lord and alluding to regeneration, which we the reader know in publication order in 1985, but which, if you are reading the Targets in story order for the first time, will still find a spoiler, as the War Games is over 30 books away. Chapter 4 keeps on with the anachronisms, the Book of Job, page 25, which was not written until several hundred years later. Chapter 5, a typically short three-page affair, is the first
TV TARDIS scene to qualify for the book. The dialogue is similar, but longer and more risque. Cotton includes the origin of the title with Makers on page 30. But I suppose, in a sense, these characters would have been the original Mythmakers. I mean the ruffians, whose rather shady little exploits were magnified by later generations until they came to seem like heroes, but they were certainly nothing of the sort. And also an oblique reference to Greek heterosexual interests. Quote, Vicky, I'd love to see the real Agamemnon. Stephen, yes, and no doubt he'd love to see you. These people weren't gentlemen, and they certainly didn't treat women, even young girls, like ladies! Exclamation point. Chapter 6 sees Homer wander from the battlefield to just outside Agamemnon's tent, where he reports on TV scenes and adds his own gently acerbic commentary. Chapter 7 preserves the wonderful confrontation between the Hartnell Doctor and Francis DeWolf's Agamemnon, losing the line from TV about the Doctor knowing Agamemnon's wife is unfaithful, but gaining for the book a great line about Agamemnon's arrest of the Doctor, page 41. If you prefer, I could describe it as a probationary period of cautionary worship. So the book, like the TV, is laugh-out-loud funny, except more outrageous, and with lots more innuendo. Chapter 8 is where Cotton starts to diverge from TV. Cyclops, Tootie Lemkow's penultimate Doctor Who contribution and final on-screen appearance, is not in the book, the character merging with Homer, but Homer himself is still a spectator at this point in the book, so Cotton removes Cyclops' two short scenes from the end of Episode 1 while retaining the cliffhanger, which ends this chapter. In a sense, Cotton's prose reminds me of Terence Dix. Not in a literal sense, vastly different writing styles and senses of humor, Cotton tending towards the suggestive, while Terence was so dry that you could die of thirst on a rainy day reading one of his longer books. But at the end of Chapter 9, elaborating on the very witty first scene of Episode 2, Cotton's Homer says, I told you he was different from all the other Greeks, didn't I? You never knew where you were with Odysseus. Cotton commenting on the action as he narrates it, just like Terence. Chapter 10, meanwhile, unwittingly takes some dialogue from Pyramids of Mars or Time Lash, which hadn't aired when this manuscript was submitted, but had aired when the book came out. Homer, hearing the Doctor explain time travel to Odysseus, muses, quote, I mean, if time travel were really possible, why? What a collaborator the Doctor would make. Already half a dozen ideas for new books were clamoring for attention in my reeling mind. Science fiction, I thought I might call them, at least until a better notion occurred. Chapter 11, as does Episode 2, resets the scene from the Greek camp to the Trojan city. When I was coming up in fandom in the early 90s, the rumor was that Hartnell demanded he never share a scene with Max Adrian, the latter of whom was, depending on the rumor, Jewish or gay. Makes you wonder how Hartnell made 2 years of weekly television with Verity Lambert, or Waris Hussein, or consented to work under Sidney Newman in the first place, if any of those rumors are true. But no, the episode was always planned this way. 60s Who made on notoriously short time frames, and Hartnell not having veto power over scene structure to that extent. This is a deviation from TV, as the Chapter 11 material actually comes before the Chapter 10 material, but Cotton's book structure of Homer traveling back and forth to witness the scenes means the book needs to have less intercutting than the TV was doing. Also in Chapter 11, Homer refers to Prince Paris as sensitive and says that Princess Cassandra resembles her late brother Hector in drag. Okay, I think we get the point there, Mr. Cotton. Chapter 12 is important, as Homer inserts himself into the narrative for the first time, seeing the Trojans are about to light the TARDIS ablaze, and alone knowing that Vicky is inside, Homer claims for himself a short speech about not burning the TARDIS, and thus inadvertently offending the gods, which is delivered by Paris on television. And then, for one brief moment, Cotton dispenses with the jokes and delivers a great valedictory to Vicky and her new name, Cressida. Bottom of page 64 to top of 65. And from that instant, she was lost forever, and at last found her proper place in time and history. For we are the prisoners of our names, more than ever we are, of what we imagine to be our destinies.
They shape our lives and mold our personalities until we fit them. We are only what our names tell us to be, and that is why they are so very important. And why, incidentally, the Doctor never revealed his own. It preserved his independence from fate and made him an unclassifiable enigma, which was an advantage in his line of work, as you will appreciate. In Chapter 13, Cotton, writing 20 years after the TV production, has Homer explain why Doctor Who stopped making historicals. Quote, "I suppose that's why in later years he, the Doctor, always preferred to go forward rather than backwards in time, so that, whatever happened, he couldn't wipe himself clean off the slate by accident. I mean, Malcolm Hulk and Ian Martyr were great writers, but watch them try to find a canonical explanation for the end of the historical. In other minor changes, the action is relocated from TV's tent to Odysseus's longship, and where on TV Stephen volunteers to answer Paris's challenge to fight Achilles, in the book he merely volunteers to enter Troy as a prisoner of war to find Vicky, not intentionally to engage in a duel. The duel, by the way, in Chapter 14 is flavored by Cotton deciding that Stephen doesn't know how to sword fight, whereas from what we know of the TV production, he was evidently at least somewhat skilled, at least as directed by Michael Leeston Smith. Chapters 15 and 16 are original to the book, and only Chapter 17 returns to the narrative, serving as the final scene of Episode 2. Chapter 15 is a fanciful invention. Homer, who's befriended Paris, helping escort Stephen as Diomede into Troy as a prisoner, with Paris giving a poorly received speech while standing atop the TARDIS and getting pelted with vegetables, while Homer extols Paris's good qualities. Chapter 16 is Homer's travelogue of Troy, which contains the immortal line about how Athens was built atop marble, whereas Troy was built on, quote, oil-bearing shale, which is of no use to anybody. Also, attention is paid to Vicky on page 83. Quote, "My word, she had done well for herself since this morning. And no mistake, the complete transformation. No longer the lovable young tomboy space urchin, but a raving beauty, secure in the knowledge of her newly discovered devastating powers, which at the moment she was turning full blast on poor young Troilus." Really, Cotton just stops the jokes and has really powerful prose when the situation calls for it. Homer also describes Helen in the book, which is a gag as Helen did not appear on TV, as Ian points out in the Black Archive. How do you cast the face that launched 1,000 ships without disappointing somebody in the audience? Cotton does have a clever workaround for that. Episode 2 takes up 42 full pages of text, the cliffhanger falling at the end of page 17. This leaves just 53 pages for the rest of the book. So, Malcolm Hulk style, it's time for Cotton to start pruning scenes and dialogue in order to get the book in under the word count. Chapter 18 really starts to take a serious left turn against television, with scenes that were not deleted from the TV version told out of order. Chapter 18 has two great sentences. One, as the Doctor reveals the Trojan horse idea, page 93, the Doctor took a deep breath and sentenced the world to Greek civilization. And on page 94, when old Homer realizes that the Doctor has stolen from his future book, what we writers really need is absolutely watertight copyright laws, but I don't suppose we'll ever get them. No, no you won't. And then Homer re-enters the narrative by jumping aboard Odysseus's ship, informing the Doctor that Vicky and Stephen are sentenced to death in Troy, and having one of his eyes blinded by Odysseus, who says, "Sorry, my hand slipped." An unforgettable image, but of course completely invented for the book, with no remote TV counterpart. Cyclops on TV having already lost his one eye long before Episode 1. In Chapter 19, Homer is back to being an unseen observer. The chapter otherwise faithfully adapts Episode 3's second scene with the Doctor, but loses Menelaus's concluding punchline. Let's give a listen.
"Now Achilles will take his myrmidons and hide out upon the plain.
Why don't you send the best warriors to be in the horse?"
"So they will be. I shall be there with my Ithacans."
"Eh?"
"My Ithacans and the Doctor, of course."
"That wasn't part of the plan."
"It is now. I've just thought of it. I'm standing no more nonsense from you, Doctor.
That will not be necessary. I shall only get in the way.
You'd better not do that. Now the rest is up to the Trojans. They see that we have gone. They see their great horse upon the plain, which has descended from heaven to drive us away.
And then they drag the horse into the city.
Are you sure? Suppose they set fire to it.
No, well, that is a calculated risk, but somehow I don't believe they'll want to destroy one of their own gods.
Yes, but once they have the horse inside, won't they close the gate?
Of course they will. But during the night, we shall leave the horse, open up the gates to let you all in again. What more do you want? A drink.
In chapters 20 and 21, Paris lends medical aid to Homer, and then relays for him episode 3's first scene, the cliffhanger resolution in the Trojan palace, before bringing him to Cressida for further care. The Homer business severely truncates the episode 3 dungeon scenes, and also removes Tutty Lumcow's other appearances. In chapter 22, Troll is his proper introduction of the book, and once again I love that chapter title, Hello Young Lovers. No, I won't sing for you. Cotton, as always, works in as many puns as he can. Page 114, a hungry Troilus, quote, fell upon the salamanders in aspic like a wolf unfolded. So Homer is conversant in Shakespeare and Byron. Well, the prologue does suggest that he later travels with the doctor, having met several of them. How about it, Big Finish? Homer's adventures with every incarnation of the Time Lord that you currently have under contract. The episode 3 cliffhanger, the infamous episode 3 cliffhanger, concludes chapter 23, as Cotton jettisons all the scenes with the Doctor, Odysseus, and the horse, meaning the book loses Odysseus' immortal line about being as nervous as a Bacchante at her first orgy. The chapter concludes on page 120, meaning we only have 22 pages left for all of episode 4. Which isn't a good sign, as how can you tell something as taut and doom-laden as episode 4 of The Mythmakers in just 22 pages of text? So the big surprise is, the taut and nerve-wracking and doom-laden episode 4 of The Mythmakers takes up just 17 pages of text, not 22. Because the first chapter, after the whoa cliffhanger, and you know what? I played that cliffhanger audio in the Ian Potter episode, but I better play it again now. I mean, right now.
Then woe to the House of Priam. Woe to the Trojans.
I think it's a bit late to say woe to the horse. I've just given instructions to have it brought into the city.
So the first scene in chapter 24, after the woe cliffhanger, is the Doctor and Ulysses and the horse, ported over from episode 3 on television and told out of order, which means that my note, as I was reading the book through, about that scene missing, well, here it is, with the Bacchante orgy line and everything. Now I am sure I would not have known what to make of that line when I was a naive of a 12-year-old. Chapter 25, page 129, and we meet, for the first time, Katarina, that five-week companion who's in just two books, and barely in this one. But I did get a shimmer of excitement on page 129. And then, amidst the general brouhaha and rejoicing, I noticed a rather striking-looking girl called Katarina, who was crying conspicuously to herself in a corner, and looking rather left out of things. I'd had occasion to notice her before, one of Cassandra's acolytes she seemed to be, and although that certainly wasn't a job calculated to cheer anyone up a great deal, nevertheless I thought she was rather overdoing the soul-sick lamentation business. You can see the faint outline of certain episode 4 Troy scenes in this chapter, but we are still missing all the sizzling Doctor and Odysseus scenes inside the horse. Let's listen to one last audio clip from the TV.
How you can sit there so peacefully defeats me. Have enough feelings? No emotions?
I was thinking, Doctor, that with any luck, either Agamemnon or Achilles will not come through.
You mean they'll desert us?
No. Die. Just a hope.
unless finger in the pie a greater share of the booty for me. That is a most immoral way of looking at life. Nonsense. The reason that I've been here for 10 long years, fighting all the time.
Sir, I must get out of here at once.
You can't.
Tell you when you've got to pull that lever and I can get back down into the square.
Yes, but as I happen to be sitting on the rope, you'll fall 40 feet and break your neck.
I will not be party to your schemes. You forced me to invent this contraption.
I'm very glad I did, Doctor. Up to now, it's been very satisfactory.
You had no right to bring me here at all. I'm utterly useless to you. You must get me out of here. You're selfish, greedy, corrupt, cheap, horrible. The one sort is for yourself from what you can get out of it.
Be quiet, old man.
I will not be quiet. You may stay here if you wish to have your insignificant wind and quicksilver, whatever you call it. But you must let me out of here.
One more word out of you and I shall kill you. You will be my last victim in joy.
And this is where we come to the part of the book that has not aged well for me. The first three episodes material work much better for me now than they did at age 12. I understand it more now, and I see that it's very faithful to the TV. But I'm aching to know what the video of episode 4 would look like. The DWM 1965 bookazine contains audience appreciation index comments on the story. The Greek soldiers climbing down from the horse and into Troy move too slowly, lamented one viewer from November 1965. Oh, if only I could see even that. But it's not in the book. The last four chapters are told solely from Homer's point of view, almost as if Cotton didn't have the episode 4 script in front of him while writing this part of the novelization, and was just vamping as he went along. In the book, Homer sends Troilus out of Troy on a false errand to save Diomede, whereas on TV that was Vicky on a slightly different pretext. In chapter 27, Homer has a side encounter with Achilles and admires the latter's sword of Damascus steel, and then cheerfully comments on the anachronism by wondering about the presence of steel in the Bronze Age. In a sideshow, Homer loses his other eye via a stray blow from a sword fight. Great writing persists, though. Page 138. Troy, and all the sane sophistication it stood for, disappeared amongst what are laughingly called the myths of antiquity. Episode 4 of Mythmakers is undeniably powerful, brutal, uncompromising. Some sterling performances in Vicky's leaving scene and reunion with Troilus, the Doctor's distraught dialogue after finding a badly wounded Stephen and having Katarina thrust upon him, the off-screen murder of Paris and King Priam, and Cassandra's final scene. I will not play the audio, as I've already played three audio clips, and this part of the episode is running a bit long, but definitely listen to that final Cassandra scene against Odysseus. It's amazing. Most of this is not in the book. All the power on television is diluted because the last four chapters take place entirely from Homer's point of view. Homer travels with Vicky and Troilus and Aeneas, and we learn towards the end that the entire book is Homer relating the story to an unseen observer who proves to be the Doctor after all, which incarnation is not specified. The ending in the epilogue is whimsical and charming, but it is so far removed from the TV. Now that is, in one sense and one sense only, a good thing. If you read the book first and watch the TV second, as did I, you are still in for the pleasantly unpleasant surprise that is episode 4 of The Mythmakers. You must see it to experience it, because the book just does not serve episode 4 at all. Next time on Doctor Who Literature, we are staying in the past, we are staying in the 1960s, but we are jumping ahead three seasons and going back to the Troughton era. This is something special indeed. It is one of the longest Target novelizations in literally years. It is written by the great Ian Martyr, based upon a TV serial directed by the great Douglas Camfield, and starring the great Patrick Troughton, and Wendy Padbury, and Nicholas Courtney, and Kevin Stoney, and Peter Halliday, and Fraser Hines. Shall I go on? a good friend of the show, is coming back once again next week as we break down Doctor Who, The Invasion. Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. This podcast is produced by David Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. This week's episode was written and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my special guest, Cy Hart, of the Maximum Power and Library of Impossible Things podcasts. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky and Mastodon at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.